on Thursday, May 27th, the Arizona State Board of for Private Postsecondary Education is hereby called to order.
Hold on 1 second, Dr. Mittman. I'm still waiting for the recording to start. Apologize. It is hanging up.
There we go. It's definitely going to impact your start time. And
it's now going to be a
I'm just kidding. I don't play golf. I'm just joking. All right. It's still 10 o'clock. Welcome, everyone, to the May 27th Arizona State Board for Private Postsecondary Education board meeting. The board, upon a majority of a quorum of the members, may go into executive session for the purpose of obtaining legal advice pursuant to ARS 38-431.03A3 on any matter on the agenda. The board reserves the right to change the order of the agenda items with the exception of hearings. The board, upon a majority vote of a quorum of members, may also go into executive session to discuss or consider records exempt by law from public inspection, including the receipt and discussion of information or testimony that is specifically required to be maintained as confidential by state or federal law. ARS 38-431.03A2. Mr. LaMountain, could you please, oh, and the board will consider, discuss, and may take action on any agenda item. Are there any changes to the agenda, Mr. LaMountain?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and board, there is one change from the initial agenda, and that would be the renewal application for Center for Excellence in Higher Education. I've already taken them off mine. As they are, they have made the decision to not renew that particular license. So that has been removed from the initial agenda.
Okay. Well, great. Mr. Lamar, call the roll, please.
I will. Roll call would be Dr. Mittman.
Present.
Mr. Romano.
Present.
Mr. Lubke.
Present.
Mr. Wallace. Mr. Wallace? I know you're on.
He was there earlier.
Yep. Mr. Wallace, you're on mute. I have a visual confirmation that Mr. Wallace is on, so Mr. Tharp?
Present.
And Mr. Ball?
Present.
And Dr. Leck will not be attending today. She is on vacation. For staff, myself, Kevin LaMountain, Executive Director, Mr. Blanchard?
Here.
And Ms. Stanfield?
Here.
And our Assistant Attorney General, Seamus Moynihan?
Here. And Kevin, if whenever Mr. Wallace unmutes himself, if he could just for the record say that he was here.
Okay, I think you're just coming back in, Mr. Wallace. Still on mute, Mr. Wallace. Now you're not on mute.
Okay, can you hear me now?
We can. Okay, great. Okay.
Thank you.
Everyone's here.
Great. And can we get a motion to accept the audio recordings as the official minutes of the board meeting for the board meeting of the April 22nd, 2021?
So moved. Glenn Tharp, board member.
I'll second that. Scott Wallace.
Thank you. Mr. LaMountain, please call the vote.
We will call roll call vote. Dr. Mittman?
Aye.
Mr. Romano?
Aye.
Mr. Lubke?
Aye.
Mr. Wallace?
Aye.
Mr. Tharp?
Aye.
And Mr. Ball?
Aye.
Great. By your vote of 6 1 2 3 4 5 6 ayes, the motion passes.
Great. Moving on, Mr. LeMann, can you give us the executive director's report?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. I've provided to you today some information in your folder with regards to the executive director's report. I wanted to give you a brief update on operations. As we talked about during our last board meeting, we continue to struggle somewhat with our 2056 account, which is our general operations account. And that would be those that we typically pay for the majority of our operations cost for staff. We still are somewhat challenged, and that has quite a bit to do with the decreased number of renewal applications, the decreased number of the applications for new programs, for change of programs, for modifications of programs. So we are down quite a bit from previous year. So those still remain a challenge. Again, as a reminder, we have not had an update in our fees for 25 years. So we still see that as an opportunity to look for perhaps some changes into the next year's legislative session. But I think at this particular point, I have it under control with the ability to split some of those funding pieces out between both this account and the Student Tuition Recovery Fund account. And I think we're going to end up, we are certainly below our allotment for our appropriation. So we will not come, we'll be quite a bit under our appropriation, which is good. But we're going to be right at where we need to be with the revenue and expenses. So I continue to monitor that on a daily basis. I've provided you both the spreadsheets for both accounts, for the operations account of 2056 and the Student Tuition Recovery Fund of 3027. Those are in your folder. I don't know if you have any specific questions.
I was just wondering, in your report, you mentioned that we were expecting a number of renewals coming in May 1st or the month of May. And I was wondering how that turned out.
Yeah, so we did. We had two schools that did not reapply, but we had 50 that are in the group that did complete their applications in May. That revenue hasn't been recognized in the report that you have. So during our next meeting, which will potentially be in August, you'll see the revenue recognized in that time frame.
Great. Thanks. Any other questions, board members?
Yes, Mr. LeMount, just a couple things. As I was looking at the information that you provided, you have a transcript request, and I was just trying to verify, is that year to date, or was that over a 30-day period?
Under the in the reporting period, that is, I just want to go back and double check. So, no, that's a monthly.
Okay.
It's about what we get on a monthly basis.
Okay.
Any other questions? Hearing none, I'll move on. The Student Tuition Recovery Fund, we're doing fine in that now that we have that change. Schools are the formerly regionally accredited institutions are now paying into that. We've received some large sums, which have been helpful. And we still have about $30,000, give or take, of additional money that has been billed that has not been paid yet for the institutions. And I've been making phone calls to those particular institutions. I listed on here the new school or location closures. The Aspen University administrative centers they're not necessarily closing. They're no longer going to be an administrative center because the Aspen University system is located now here in Arizona. So they're allowed to have and bring all of the activities that they had in those particular sites into and under one particular license. So that is happening. The Prominio Tech, if you guys remember Prominio, he has decided to not continue operations along with the Arizona Academy of Air Conditioning. Both those institutions have since closed. We do have the student records for both Prominio and for Arizona Academy of Air Conditioning. You see the dashboard. Current number of schools is 216. Our prior year we had 212. We do still have about 20 applications that are in the pending folder that are they're awaiting the institutional completion of those particular applications. So Keith has been working with those schools and getting them to get to the point where they've actually submitted. And then you'll see that we have four submissions, and then three of those schools are being represented today during this particular board meeting. Some of the no real change in the ed monitoring from last reporting period. Certainly the Accreditation Action Center for Excellence in Higher Education, you did see my board report on that, and that particular institution has elected not to continue operating their call center, their administrative center in the state of Arizona. They are to close. My understanding is that they're closing on June 29th. Mr. Blanchard and I will be going over to the facility sometime in early July to make sure that they're in compliance with that closure of that particular facility. In terms of legislative update, the legislative session is getting close to completion, we hope. Most everyone hopes. They're going through the budget reconciliation right now, and could be next week, but it could be longer. One particular point to note about the legislation that did drop in terms of the budget is, if those of you that know about the post-secondary commission, the Post-Secondary Commission has, since losing the 529 plan to the Arizona Department of Treasury, they have had some challenges with funding, and they were determining what the next best steps are for the commission. As of this week, we were notified that it looks as though the Post-Secondary Commission is going to fall under the guidance of the Arizona Board of Regents. I know that there's some individuals that are questioning that particular move, but as far as board staff is concerned, you know, that this is not something that presents us with any particular concern. So, but that will be in the reconciliation budget. It has actually officially moved under ABOR. And then staffing. Obviously, Rachel is no longer with us. I made that statement a couple of weeks ago, and I'm creating a different position, a records management position for that, for her role. And I have resumes, and I've already interviewed some individuals for that. So we hope to have that particular position filled within the next 2 weeks. And with that stated, that's all I have for my executive director report. If there are any questions?
Just a couple, Mr. Lamone. In regards to the Center for Excellence and their closing of their call center operations, and I believe they only have one remaining campus in operation within the country at this point, from that standpoint. Anything from a student risk standpoint of what possibly could be a pending system-wide closure for them?
The Mr. Chairman, Mr. Romano, the Center for Excellence in Higher Education and their call center, there was really no particular risk in that. The institution that they do have in the state of Arizona, which is College America, the one in Phoenix at Metro Center, that is in the process of closing. They have at last, they provided us the last data upload of transcripts and ledger cards, and I believe there was 36 that are still left in there. But in terms of a bond, we have a bond that is well in excess of what we would need at this particular point if the school were to close precipitously.
Great, thank you for that. And then one other question in regards to ABOR and the budget piece and kind of falling under that. Is there anything you can provide us guidance with on how that may impact budgeting decisions or having to go through different processes to get approvals on the necessary budget to operate?
Well, that wouldn't be for us. That would be for the commission.
Okay.
for the post-secondary commission. And I love those guys, and I'm going to let them handle that all on their own.
Great. Okay. Thank you. I just didn't quite understand that overlap, so I appreciate the clarification.
Great. Thank you. Okay. Hearing no other questions, Dr. Mittman?
Great. I do have one last question with regard to the Strike Fund. Is there any update on SUVA and any impact on the Strike Fund from the closure of that institution?
Dr. Mittman, thank you. We have had no additional Strife claims that have come in. Again, we still have until December of this year for that to, that they still have the ability to file a claim. But as of today, the three that we heard during our last meeting were the only three that we had to date. Now, I will tell you that there are certainly some concerns that I'm working with the state of New Mexico regarding student transcripts. We don't seem to have those. I have a call into the bankruptcy court, bankruptcy judge, to see if there's any type of, and we're also missing quite a few transcripts that we've seen at this point in time as well. So we're reaching out to make sure that we get every possible resource that's available to the state through the federal bankruptcy court.
Okay. Well, thank you to you and Mr. Blanchard for all the work that goes kind of above and beyond the ordinary running of the office to deal with, you know, unforeseen issues, although maybe not so unforeseen, but whatever. Okay, well, great. Moving on. Next item on the agenda is request for bond reduction, and that would be the Cummings Graduate School. And I'm lead on that, and so we have Dr. English and Ms. Harrison. Are you guys both here?
Hi, I'm Amanda Harrison. I'm here today to present on this, and Dr. Kara English is on the phone.
Okay, well, good. Well, go ahead.
Good morning, all. I appreciate your time today on letting us present to the board. Cummings Graduate Institute is coming to you today to ask for a reduction in its bond. Originally, when we were receiving our conditional license, there was a lot of, I believe, hesitation from the board as a new degree-granting school who was unaccredited back in 2015, 2016. And so there was a bond placed on us of $100,000 to protect the students in case of need to use that. And in 2019, the school received full accreditation through DEAC, and we are currently in the renewal process for the next phase of our accreditation, which would we're hoping to get the next accreditation for 5 years. But we'd like to reduce the surety bond to fit what is required of us through the board rules, basically. And so I had drafted up a letter to Kevin to share with you all, and I don't know if that's been received, but last year our gross tuition revenue at the end of the fiscal year was $158,200. And so the required amount that we're supposed to have, if I did my calculations correct based upon the rules and regulation sheet, is a base of $15,000. And then an additional bond amount required if gross tuition revenue is less than $400,000, and that's 15% of that annual gross tuition revenue. And so taking that into account, that would bring us to $23,730 plus the $15,000 for a total of $38,730 that we're asking if we can reduce our surety bond to. Our projected gross tuition revenue for 2021 is $250,000, and so we can discuss too if we need to do it based upon what's to come this year. But I also wanted to inform you all that we did receive a $5 million donation from Dorothy Cummings in March 2021 to be used over the next 5 years for operational expenses. So it's divided into $1 million per year, and that $1 million covers the base operations of the institution as it operates today. And so that's why we're coming to you today to request if we can drop the surety bond down to be within line of what's required of us.
Okay. Well, great. Well, thank you, Ms. Harrison and Dr. English, and congratulations again.
Thank you.
I think we talk about that every year. and so any questions or comments from the from the board. I'm the lead on this, and I think most of us have seen the development of the Graduate Institute over the years, and so I'll just leave it open to other board. Yeah.
I think this is just for board staff. When you look at the recommendations here and how they've calculated it, it seems consistent with how we would have calculated it versus that of the CGI Board of Directors. Can you validate that, Mr. Romano?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Romano, that would be correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? I think I'm in agreement, and I believe staff is in agreement that this is appropriate. Motion to reduce the surety bond to $38,730. Can I get a motion, a second rather?
Michael Romano, second.
Great. Ms. Harrison, do you agree to the stipulation?
I agree. Thank you.
Okay, good. Mr. LeMond, could you please call the roll
for the vote? Great. Dr. Mittman?
Aye.
Mr. Romano?
Aye.
Mr. Lupke?
Aye.
Mr. Wallace?
Aye.
Mr. Tharp?
Aye.
Mr. Ball?
Aye.
A vote of 6 ayes, the motion passes.
Thank you all so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And be well.
Thank you as well. Have a great day.
Okay. Next up, licensing. So we have a license renewal application conditional to regular for CompTIA Tech Career Academy. And Mr. Tharp, you are the lead.
I should think about that. Yeah.
I am indeed. Do I have any members of the school here representing?
Yes, you do. I had to turn on my camera. I can't tell if I've got it on now, but I think I do. I'm Sayla.
You do.
Okay, great. I'm Sayla Roberts. I'm the senior compliance analyst, and I just asked our chief academic officer to join. He has been in multiple meetings, so you may just be talking to me today.
Okay. Do you want to make any statement? How's it going with the school, especially this last year, given the pandemic?
Cool. It's been really interesting. I guess, in a nutshell, we are headquartered in Illinois, and we have a few other residential campuses, including one in Arizona. But during the pandemic, we had to focus to online. So it has definitely been a challenge, especially when we're now trying to reopen our residential locations. All the different states have different rules, so it's been a challenge. But we've still had students enrolling, and we want to go forward.
Good. What's your population been looking like? You've been acquiring students?
We have. It's definitely been lower than expected. But we feel that once students are able to actually go into classrooms more, that we will gain more students. While online programs, we build them out to be the same or as close as possible to our residential programs, I feel like a lot of students, especially for these short-term IT programs, really want to be there and be present.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah, I just know it's different times for all of us, and I come to you since it's computer training.
We were able to pivot to online training really quickly, which was nice, but it's still been a real challenge for everybody.
Everybody.
No matter how prepared you might have thought you were, it's been hard. Okay.
Your application was well put together, so thank you for that.
And oh, great.
My review a little bit easier, but I do have a few things I'd like to discuss just so I can get some clarification. First, it's a housekeeping note. Your certificate of liability insurance is expired. It expired on the 15th of this month. So,
yes, I sent Kim via email a new one on May 19th.
Okay, so Kevin, you have it?
I can resend that if you need.
No, I'll just confirm with board staff if they have it.
Okay.
I will keep going, and I will double check, make sure that it's in our system.
Yeah, it's just a reminder. If not, you'll need to get that to them. Okay.
Kevin, I'll check that right now.
Okay.
Thanks, Keith. Okay. Went through the enrollment agreement, and I really don't have any questions for there. It met the standard, so that's good. What we need. A few things when we go through the catalog, just mostly for clarification. I look at this through the eyes as if I was a student coming in, you know. So on page 6, it says successful completers will earn their CompTIA certification in that first paragraph. Can you guarantee that they will earn it? I know they have to get through the program, but that's a declarative statement that they will earn it.
Well, that statement is saying a person who is a successful completer will earn it.
Got it.
So I think.
Yeah, I think it's fine. And it's
semantics. I don't know if you have any.
No, I think if I read it, you know.
Because I do, I did make sure. I'm sorry. I did make sure to include a statement very clear that we never guarantee employment, but I don't have something there about.
No, but if I, you know, my only concern with there is if I was a student, I'd come to you and say, well, in your catalog it says I will earn it. I didn't pass, but you said I will earn it, so how will I earn it? You know,
I said it.
But it's, I mean, but semantically it says successful program completers will ever, and that's what you need, so I think you're safe there. I just
okay.
Yeah, and then you don't guarantee job persistent. So if a student has more than one absence and they're dropped from the program, then
that's correct. We have a very, very, very strict attendance policy. We've actually this is something that actually comes up every once in a while where we re-debate it, but it's our senior leadership has one absence, and that's it.
Well, I mean, again, it's a short-term program.
And, yes, it is.
But the reason I question that is, you know, according to your catalog and the standards, the people would have to make up missed time anyway. So if I had a family death and I had to go away for 2 days, you're saying I'm going to be dropped from the program. I guess I could apply for an LOA, but
yeah,
a two-day LOA is not going to happen. So I just want to make sure.
Yeah, that's actually a very good point. Thank you for bringing that up. So I was going to say if a student came to us and said they needed to go away for like a long weekend, procedurally we would instruct them to complete an LOA. But I'm wondering what else we can do there.
No, I think constructively, if that's what you do, I mean, since you don't take federal funds, you're not under the same compliance rules of the LOA. That's something you do internally. That wouldn't work at the, you know, a Title IV school. You can put somebody in LOA for 2 days and then bring them back, or 3 days and put them back. So just as long as you have a plan for that, because
okay.
I can see that question coming up from students.
Yeah, I can definitely see that coming up too.
Yeah. So can you speak to me a little bit about why you guys have the 14-day rule to complete the CompTIA certification and A+?
Well, the 14 days is to give students who, if they do not pass one of the exams the first time, to give them additional time to complete it. We're setting this up. The 14-day rule was originally established because our consultants that we've been working with for accreditation advised us to set up that time frame to help us later down the road for Title IV. So that is our main reasoning right now.
Okay. I mean, I get it. It's just, again, it's a question as a consumer.
Something
happened and I had to wait, you know, 15, 16 days to take the test. Your catalog does not provide any wiggle room that you could allow that.
No.
Because you say will be dropped in many places here from them. So they would.
Yes, and we have done that to students, in fact.
Okay. Well, just know that you have to abide by that. And if you get pushed back, it is what it is, you know. So page did I have? Under admissions requirements on page 14 of your catalog. I just had a question about ability to speak, read, write, and understand English. And
okay.
My question is, how do you assess that? What mechanism, what tool, what
That's interesting, because we've actually discussed this a number of times. And this was something that I put into our giant accreditation report. But we are assessing English language during the admissions process. There's a standard rubric that our admissions people are using when they're having the online interview with the students. And, you know, one of the things that they're doing is evaluating how well they can speak English or understand English. The requirement for the Wonderlic assessment that all students must take and achieve at least a 19 score, while it's not specifically evaluating English language, we use that test as a way to gauge proficiency.
Yeah, again, many of us do. That's why we use, I mean, that's one of the things for using the SLE exam, you know, to do. I just want to make sure, because you do say you assess it, and I don't have a copy of the rubrics, but as long as you have an objective rubric that you could, that can stand up. But when it gets into the subjective area, when you're,
yeah,
not,
yeah.
when you're not using a tool, and I just say, well, Ms. Roberts, I don't think you speak English well enough to come to this program.
Yeah, that would
you can imagine that you're probably going to see Mr. Romano and I at the complaint committee. So, and as much as we like you, we don't want to see you at the complaint committee.
No, I don't want that either.
We don't like that. So, so just be aware of that, okay?
Yes, noted.
And then you answered my next one, I guess. So you do have objective rubrics to grade interviews, right?
Yes, we do.
Okay, because that's another thing that gets called question quite often is how did you evaluate the student?
Oh, yeah.
Any bias to them. So as long as you got that, and that's good, that looks good. Uh-oh, somebody got an accident.
Yeah, I live in downtown Chicago, so it's ambulances.
Oh, I remember. I used to have a campus in downtown Chicago.
Oh,
right
did
now.
You? But,
yeah, in the Silversmith District, so I was – always there, and that's always what I remember about Chicago, the constant sirens, anyway. So the total time frame is you really are giving up to 12 months and 180 days, somebody to be gone from your program and come back?
If they, well, I'm sorry, hold on, let me go to absence policy.
On page 20, it's just the LOA policy, but I just want to come
through. Because, one second here. Yes, okay. I wanted to make sure we had an old, outdated leave of absence policy, and I just wanted to double-check and make sure this one was included. We have up to 180 days. Again, this was determined in consultation with our consultants and following the Accreditation Council for Continuing Education and Training's rules guiding a leave of absence.
So yeah.
That's what we based it on.
Yeah, I mean, that's the general federal standard anyway. But anyway, so, okay, just wanted to confirm.
Yeah, I mean, if they really wanted to, it's a possibility.
Then on page 21, and I'm sure I understand this correctly, but you guys are a pass-fail school, right?
That's correct.
But then you go on to say they have to have 70%.
That's for grading, or that's for evaluating satisfactory academic progress.
Okay, so. But it is a pass-fail. You either pass or you do not. Okay, good. Okay, now let's do that. I think we're at the end. I think I was good with everything else in here that I met. I checked your refund policy, and that all matches transcripts in Arizona. So, yeah, that really concludes my questioning. So I will kick it over, Mr. Chairman, to you or the board members, if anybody else has questions for Ms. Roberts.
Any other questions for Ms. Roberts?
Yeah, this is Scott Wallace. My question gravitates towards the financial statements. And can you explain to us the relationship of the academy to the, I think you have a foundation and then you have another entity out there.
Yeah. Adam, are you on? I believe he has called in. One second, please. Mm-hmm. Oh, he says that he's muted.
Oh.
He needs to push star six.
Yeah, if he's on his phone.
Okay. Sorry.
All right. This is Adam. Can you hear me now?
There you go.
Yes.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
When I logged on, I thought it said pound six. But, yes, it's star six. So, good afternoon, everybody. I'm out on the East Coast today. Looking at the entities, we are a subsidiary of CITF, a separate entity from the foundation.
Right, so if I understand it, and I'm glad that Mr. Wallace asked the question, he's an actual accountant. In reading through the financial statements, there's three entities. There's a trade association, right, that is in the technical field. The trade association has a foundation, right, and then there's an academy. And the three are interrelated, and the financial statements and the audit, the support from the related party is referencing foundation support that goes to the academy. And then it looks like the trade association are some of the staff members who are actually teaching classes. Is that correct? It seems very convoluted. And so, it's not an issue for me, but it would be interesting to understand it.
Yes, and there's a bit of history there also. So the trade association is CompTIA, which is, you know, it's the largest nonprofit IT association. And then Creating IT Futures Foundation historically was a separate entity. Several years ago, CompTIA absorbed Creating IT Futures into the larger association. And then we also established the Academy as a separate subsidiary of Creating IT Futures Foundation. Does that provide, and that's why there might be, it might seem a bit murky around the details of staffing, because we do have individuals that are on CompTIA's payroll, because that is the mother company, if you will. That's the mothership, and then everything else cascades down from there. But the Academy is a separate entity altogether as a subsidiary of Creating IT Futures.
Okay, the reason why I brought up the question is that the Academy, its biggest asset is an amount due from a related party, and simultaneously it has a comparable amount owed on accounts payable and accrued expenses, which it may be reasonable, but and the footnote six, I think, to the financial statements explains, you know, where the 827 is due from, and I guess my question is that you must feel this way, and your auditors must feel that the 827 is collectible. I presume it's been collected by now, since this is over 4.5 months. Is that an accurate statement?
It is, and we don't use cash basis. We use an accrual method, and GAAP, you know, with GAAP principles, we can't recognize until service are delivered. So even if we have the money on the books, we don't recognize it due to that accrual method until post service is being delivered or executed.
Okay. All right.
So, Ms. Sella and Adam, based on my general description of my understanding, would I get a pass or a fail on that? Was that like a 70% understanding of the
structure? We made SAP.
Good. You're going to send me back for remediation. Okay, good. And thanks again for asking it. Mr. Wallace, I knew that that would come up, and it's definitely clearer for me now. Any other questions for CompTIA? Hearing
Ready to make a motion then, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, I thought I was going to have to change my tea time. Go ahead.
Yep. No, I'm going to make a motion. I'd like to make a motion that we approve the conditional to regular vocational program licensing for CompTIA Tech Career Academy with the following stipulations, that they maintain the $15,000 surety bond.
Can we get a second?
A second. This is Doug Ball.
Okay. And then
the mountain. Oh, and
well, let's ask if Ms. Roberts.
Ask question. Ask it. We always have to ask this question. Go ahead, Mr. Tharp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you guys, does the school agree to those stipulations?
Yes, we agree.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. LaMountain, please call the vote.
Great, thank you. And just to confirm, Mr. Tharp, that we do have the updated certificate of insurance with the correct date on it. So
great. Thank you. Yeah, that would. I figured you did, so that's why I didn't add it in my motion.
Okay. Dr. Mittman?
Aye.
Mr. Romano?
Aye.
Mr. Lubke?
Aye.
Mr. Wallace?
Aye.
Mr. Tharp?
Aye.
Mr. Ball?
Aye.
By your vote of 6 ayes and no nays, the motion passes.
Okay. Well, congratulations, you guys.
Thank you.
Congratulations, everyone.
And, thank you.
Go do good things.
We shall.
Okay, next up on the agenda is a change of ownership for LS Coding Academy. And Mr. Wallace, you are the lead.
Mr. Wallace, you're on mute.
So much for that. I saw Sharon Jones log in earlier. Are you there? And is anybody accompanying you on this call? Maybe she's on mute. There she is.
Sharon?
Sharon?
Sharon Jones? She is. Sharon, we see that you're on, but we cannot hear you or see you. Is Trish on? Trish Krebs?
He must be frightened.
Sharon? I know Sharon was the first one that logged in today, so she's been on for a few. Ms. Jones? If you would, Ms. Jones, going once, going twice. If you would prefer, we can move on to the next item and then come back.
Where are they staying in Phoenix?
Okay, let's do that. And can everyone who's not speaking, please mute your phone or your whatever, computer, phone, et cetera. All right, let's go on, and we'll start with Alverno College. And this is an initial application, and Mr. Lukey, you are the lead.
Well, very good. Good morning. We have somebody on the line from Alverno College.
We do. I'm Lori Kunkel-Jordan. I'm the interim dean of the Joanne McGrath School of Nursing and Health Professions, and I also have Peg Rauschenberger along with me. She's the Associate Dean of the School of Adult Learning and New Initiatives. And then lastly, Katie Dillo, who is our VP of Finance.
All right, very good. Do you have an opening statement for the board?
I'm going to defer to Peg. She's been involved with the development of the program from the beginning.
Yes, hello. And thanks for talking with us today. We are very excited about this. And I may go on and on, so just give me the hook, you know, if you think this is more than you need to know. Alverno College, just to give you a little background, which I'm sure you've read a bit, but was founded back in 1890 by the School Sisters of St. Francis. So we are a a fairly small liberal arts Catholic college in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We started a nursing program, the Sacred Heart School of Nursing, in 1930, and began offering the baccalaureate degree in nursing in 1951. So we have been around and known for our nursing education for a very long time. In 2005, we began offering the Masters of Science nursing degrees, and we have various tracks in that. We have a president, Sister Andrea Lee, who around in 2017 created a new strategic plan for Alverno to expand its footprint in healthcare. And so we have been working under that strategic plan and its revisions ever since then, and began talking about offering here in Milwaukee a direct entry MSN program for students who have a degree in something else and want to become a nurse. And so that is the program we began in January of 2020 in partnership with Synergis, who is based in Mesa, Arizona. And that partnership is a revenue sharing partnership. And it, because we are a small Catholic college, the partnership has allowed us to have marketing dollars that we would not have been able to provide here at the college. And so working with Synergis, this program has taken off. We feel a great commitment to healthcare. Nursing is the largest major at Alverno, and we look at the shortage of nurses that is looming across the United States. Arizona especially is going to need 28,000 more nurses by 2025. And Wisconsin is close behind. So we see this program as being able to take people who already have a college education but have an interest in healthcare, take them to being a nurses, but also take them on to that master's degree, not an advanced practice, but more of a leadership care delivery specialist kind of person, an entry into practice nurse, but with a master's degree, and get them into the workforce in 5 semesters. And so it has been very successful here with waiting lists like crazy. And so we decided in partner with Synergis that we would like to come to Arizona, number one, because of the need for nurses there, and because, too, the support that Synergis can give us for getting started there, and because of our commitment to healthcare in general. So that is why we made the application to have a second location for this program in Mesa. I don't know how much more you want me to say to start.
I think that's a great introduction. Thank you very much. Not sure, Dr. Mittman, how I got put on this case. Maybe it's because I'm a Milwaukee native. Maybe somewhere in the college, they said there are so many cheeseheads out there in Arizona that we better go out and service them. Well, very good. I do have a few questions. Your application looks very strong. Just for the rest of the board, I would just share with you that they have already been tentatively approved by the Arizona State Board of Nursing, who really has more jurisdiction than we do. which is a good sign. And I think you're going to be receiving final approval and perhaps at the next meeting of the board. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So probably the one thing that I want to talk about a little bit is your partnership with Synergis. Now, Synergis is a for-profit entity, and you're a non-profit entity.
Yes.
Okay. So it's a master, as I understand it, it's a master service agreement. Is that correct?
Katie, I think that's correct.
Hi, yes, that is correct. We do have a master service agreement with Synergis because, as Peg spoke of, we have a couple of programs locally here in Milwaukee that we partner with them on. We do have a specific program agreement also that is housed under the master services agreement that is specific to this program delivery in Arizona as well.
Okay, very good. So in going through the agreement, there was one thing that caused me a little bit of discomfort, and that is that Alverno has sort of an obligation to their master service contractor to accept all students that meet the admissions criteria. And so looking at the admissions criteria, you know, some things, it's all pretty straightforward, but I guess what I would ask you is, you must have some sort of an interview process for each nurse applicant.
We do have an admission rubric of requirements for admission. And then we ask them to write. We don't do an in-person interview, but they do write if there seems to be an exception needed, if they have a lower GPA from their original degree, if they have a pattern of lack of success in, for instance, the sciences specifically. Then we will contact them, talk with them, and see if, you know, sometimes this is, you know, quite some time ago that they got their original degree, people change, but we do make decisions, we do make exceptions, but it's very rare outside the rubric. Because it's such an in-demand, we can be very, we can stick to our admission criteria very closely. We want to set students up for success. So
sure. And I think the rubric seems fine. You know, there's a part of nursing that is not represented by the metrics that you have on your rubric. Right? There's a part of nursing that is, what kind of human being are you? How do you see providing care, especially in a Catholic setting, I would think. How do you provide care, right? And what is your view of death and dying and any number of issues that would normally come out in an interview? And I'm a little troubled that the rubric is going to stand on its own and that you're bound to it because of your master service agreement, that you have to accept everyone who passes these minimum requirements.
Well, you know, I'm going to argue back a little bit. Okay. You know, it's not unlike our baccalaureate degree in nursing. You know, students come to us from high school.
Right.
And we don't interview them about their views on those kinds of things.
Do you interview them?
No.
No interviews. Wow. Okay.
They get to know their admission counselor, of course. We meet them. But there isn't a formal admission interview that someone has to pass. to get into a nursing program. The whole process of the curriculum takes people from, you know, they have this desire, and this is often like, I want to help people. It's really a science degree. It's the science, but it has to have come with compassion and empathy. But what we do in the curriculum is help them to grow those viewpoints about what it means to provide care for someone. I don't think people necessarily come into the degree having given all of that a lot of thought. So that's some of the walk them through in the curriculum.
Okay.
Lori, do you want...
Well, the other thing I guess I would add to that, Peg, is that our philosophy of education is a little bit different at El Borno than maybe some standard institutions. So I'm sure that there are faculty that would argue if we conducted an interview that there would be a degree of subjectivity in that, that really we, on the whole, try to avoid.
Okay.
Is that a fair statement, Peg?
I think so.
Okay. All right. Hey, it's your program. I just want to throw it out there. Just wanted to hear what's coming into our marketplace.
Well, I'm just going to say I don't disagree with you about the, what we want for the outcome.
No. I understand. Yeah. No, it's all good. Okay. Let's visit a little bit about, and maybe Katie, you could help us to better understand how the school is progressing.
I'm getting a lot of feedback right now.
Yeah, we got one too many mics open.
Okay, I didn't quite catch that question. If you could repeat it.
Happy to. Fiscal year 2018 and 2019 were showing losses. Can you give the board a feel for how this fiscal year, since we're just about a month away from the ending, how you're doing this fiscal year and what the forecast is for the coming year?
Yeah, absolutely. So for fiscal 21, which is what we are currently in, which will end at the end of June, is our fiscal year. We are expecting to exceed our budget targets. We did actually, I will say, we planned for a loss, an operational loss. And that was the result of intending to be very realistic about assumptions coming into a fiscal year, knowing the ramifications of COVID on enrollment and on operations. But through, I'll say, a combination of those conservative enrollment targets, and then we, from an enrollment standpoint for this current fiscal year, we were down in some programs from where we thought we were going to be, but we exceeded our expectations in other programs. And I will say that it was actually our program, our DEMSN program, the same program that we are holding here in Milwaukee, is the one that most exceeded our expectations and really helped to overcome losses that we or revenue shortfalls that we had in other areas. And then combined with conservative spending, knowing it was a difficult year and some of the stimulus funding that we received to cover some of those costs, we're going to end the year in the black. So we will have a little bit, we expect to be a little bit above break even for the year. And as we enter into our fiscal 22 budget, we're being realistic and we're continuing to forecast an operational loss or budget for an operational loss for the year, but reducing that. So we're really working to reduce that from what we had expected this year. And I fully believe that we will be able to meet or exceed those expectations. I will also add that there are levers that we could pull to not be budgeting for an operating loss, but we are making some very intentional investments to ensure long-term sustainability that we feel are necessary to prioritize for that long-term sustainability over short-term.
Great. Well, that's a nice turnaround. You have sufficient reserves based on what I see in your balance sheet
to yes.
cover these short-term operational losses.
Absolutely.
Okay. That's good. One question. I know your history is a college that basically has been sort of a women's college. The program that you're going to have out in Mesa, will the average truck driver, the guy that wants to be a nurse, is he going to be able to join the ladies in the nursing classroom? Or?
Yes. All of our graduate programs admit men. Oh, we aren't anti-men.
Oh, nice. Nice. Okay.
But our traditional undergrad weekday, you know, college yeah. is yeah. still in all women's. Our charter is in all women's college.
Oh, yeah. All right.
And so the truck driver can apply as long as he has a degree in something.
All right. Well, good. There's hope for Mr. Romano then. Okay. Well, with that, I am going to turn the questioning over to my colleagues on the board and see if they have any further questioning for me.
I do have a couple questions just in regards to the kind of pro forma and the student count. You gave financial numbers, but I was trying to get a sense of how many students you were really planning on seeing growth from in Arizona. Can you expound on that?
Our intent is for the first cohort, fingers crossed, with all of you and the State Board of Nursing, the first cohort entering in August of 2022 would be 24 students. And we are looking for the first three cohorts or so to be 24, and then perhaps 32. But we don't want to grow too fast. But we know we can fill those spots by just the numbers we have here. We have about 200 students currently here.
Okay. Thank you for that. And then I'm also trying to kind of reconcile the refund policy piece for students. And the way I see it in your enrollment agreement and catalog suggests that after day 8 of a class, that the students are financially responsible for the entire class. And I'm just trying to reconcile how many days your courses are normally, and if that lives into the requirements that we have in regards to percent complete of the course. So I guess to clarify, first question, how many days are your typical courses?
Once a week.
So once a week over a term of 12 weeks or?
15, 16.
Okay. So essentially at that point on day 8 of their class, they've hit a threshold of 50%. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. That's helpful for me. And then you, and certainly within your rights, essentially saying, hey, if by day 8, day 7, essentially, if you drop, you don't owe anything. So it's a zero or full after they hit the 50% threshold. I just want to make sure I understand that correctly.
Katie, I'm not sure. I think there is a portion.
I can get the answer to that. I don't have it off of the top of my head. There are situations where we do have some portions, but I can find out exactly what it means for this program.
Okay. Yeah, if just to verify, we would want to have that clearly stated. As of right now, with the materials that you've provided, it suggests that until that student hits that 50% threshold, they owe nothing. They have no obligation, and they would be a full refund for that course based on how I'm interpreting it on your EA and your course catalog. So if that is not the case, we would ask that that be reflected appropriately.
Well, and I'm just going to say, I believe that what we're saying is true, but I was thinking there might be a fee that's non-refundable, like $200 or something. I'm not sure.
Yeah,
so
you
Katie will look that up.
You do not disclose that in any portion on the EA or catalog that I could see based on even from your cost of admittance. From that standpoint, I may have overlooked it, but at least everything that suggests from tuition to books to uniforms to the kit, and then other fees that are kind of all bundled together, there's nothing stating that the student would not receive anything but a full refund as long as they did not hit the 50% threshold. So if that, totally fine if that's the case, but if it's not and you want to act differently, right, you would need to call that out very clearly.
Got it. We'll double check.
Thank you. No further questions from me.
All right. Thanks. Any other board member have a question for the team from Alverno?
Yeah, can I ask you, looking at the master service agreement at the appendix at the back, the list of services. Could you just clarify for me the role that Synergist plays in course development? Like I know that there are some areas where they will transfer, let's say it was an on-ground class, into the learning management system, and they'll have, provide all the instructional design. And, but there's also some for new course development. And could you just kind of share just how the college, you know, navigates that process? Because I'm sure you have all these courses in existence already.
Right. I'll tell you, we are very firm in that the faculty own the curriculum. The Alverno faculty own the curriculum. What Synergist does for us is, because we want a consistent look and feel to the course management software, those kinds of things, and what they call a FIG, which is a unit by unit assignments, outcomes, all of those. What they do is they assist the faculty member in creating that. They do not have input into the content in any way. And so still make suggestions sometimes, like, oh, you might want to do this, but the faculty can say, no, that's not how it flows in nursing. That's not how it's going to, you know. So they help us with that translation.
You're on mute.
There, I know. Anyone from Synergist on the call? Okay, so how long is the agreement?
It was a 10-year agreement.
Okay, and how many years are you into it?
Katie, it started, correct, January of 2020?
No, I think we signed the agreement. Sorry, go ahead.
Right. We entered the first class. The first cohort, January of 2020.
Okay. So I was going to say, how long before you, like, just reverse engineer all of the, as a learning institution, how long before you learn everything that you need to learn about?
So there's definitely something to be said for that. But from what I've seen, and I will be candid, I've only been with the college for not quite a year. So I have the benefit of being able to sort of enter and look at all this with fresh eyes. And everything that I have seen so far, I think from and Peg talked about this a bit, the market access that they give us, that the partnership with Synergist gives us, is really where the value comes to us and in the enrollment process. So I think the program development, as it was touched on, you know, the curriculum is ours, and that is clear. There are ways that we could do this ourselves, but I think I firmly believe it would be more resource intensive for us to do this ourselves than to leverage the resources and access that they have to get students. We are seeing students from areas of the country that in Milwaukee, you know, come to Milwaukee that we haven't in the past. And that is valuable to us, and we expect the same in Arizona.
Well, good. And I work at a school that also works with a content, whatever the strategy.
Sure, yeah.
And in fact, I believe taken ASU, which is, you know, obviously has the resources to do a lot of things on its own, works with Pearson, and so, you know, it's very common.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for clarifying that for me, and I appreciate all that you're doing, and it's a nice ending the vote. It'll be nice to welcome you guys to Arizona. And I happen to live in Mesa, and so
Thank you.
Paul doesn't know who Bart Starr is, so.
Oh, he stole my heart.
I can tell you that in Packer lore, I know that I was still a child when they won their first two Super Bowls. Bart Starr was the quarterback. And I don't know how many other people on this call, but I have been to Lambeau Field and watched the Packers play the Cowboys. It wasn't a very good game for the Packers. And I didn't realize when my friends asked me if I wanted to go to a Packers game that it was going to be like a half a day pub club. To get to
It's a wonderful experience.
Football is an event in Wisconsin. Yeah.
For sure. Excuse me, members of the board. This is Seamus Monahan, Assistant Attorney General. I just wanted to note for the record that I'm a Chiefs fan, and this conversation about the Packers was not agendized properly, so we can't talk about it.
Fair enough. Well, if there are no other questions for our friends from Wisconsin, I'm prepared to make a motion. Very well. I move to approve their application with stipulation that they post a surety bond of $95,000. Ms. DeLillo, Ms. Jordan, Ms. Marschenberger, do you agree to the stipulation?
Yes, we have that in place.
Yes.
Right. I'll second the motion.
Right. Very good. Okay. Mr. You call the vote.
I will call the roll. Dr. Mittman?
Aye.
Mr. Romano?
Aye.
Mr. Luke?
You betcha.
That's an aye. Thank
you. You betcha.
Mr. Waller.
Aye.
Mr. Tharp.
Aye.
Mr. Ball.
Aye.
By your vote of five ayes, one you betcha, and which I believe is an aye, the motion passes.
Thank you so much. Okay. We're very excited.
Thank you. Dr. Mittman, we can move either forward with the initial applications or go back to Ms. Jones for the change of ownership.
If Ms. Jones is available, let's do the LS Coding Academy.
Okay, great. Ms. Jones? We can't hear you. We can see you.
Okay, I'm Trish Krebs. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. So I'm watching you, but I'm on my phone. For some reason, we couldn't find the microphone on the computer. But I know that Sharon is in the meeting as well.
I am here. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Is that you, Sharon?
Okay. Yeah, so I had to call in So you're going to see my lips moving on my camera, but I'm on the phone, so I'm a dial-in caller now.
Okay. All righty. Okay. Well, this is Scott Wallace. This is my case here, and I wanted to know if either one of you two ladies would like to make an opening comment about your organization and the change of ownership.
Yes, absolutely. So this is Sharon Jones. We're just here today to request the approval for our change of ownership application to continue the LS coding and education that was previously under Lynn Schuller. She wanted to retire back in June of 2019 and asked us to consider taking over for her rather than having her close the school down. And so we agreed to that, and we're just anticipating continuing on what she's already started.
Okay. How's the school doing during this pandemic, and how have you done?
We've done well. Obviously, our revenue has went down some, but we've continued to maintain enrollment. Of course, with everybody being at home, it did boost some of our enrollment. As far as the online option, we've always operated online, so it wasn't a big change for us. We did have to kind of modify the software that we use. And, of course, with our live classes, we had to cancel. We were able to incorporate Zoom. So we didn't really have to stop anything for maybe a period of maybe 2 months to get everything, you know, back to normal and up and running for everybody online. But other than that, we've been managing just fine.
Okay, in terms of your catalog and application forms and things like that, have you made changes since you've taken over ownership?
Not very much. There's been just a few wording changes, but other than that, we've pretty much maintained everything as the way it was previously. Lynn Schuller is actually still on contract with us as part of our purchase agreement. So that we can ensure a smooth transition and, you know, make sure that everything is continuing to run the way it was intended to run.
Okay. You purchased her LLC membership interest, which means yes. You assume all the liabilities that may be on the financial statements or not on the financial statements. Have there been any adverse issues arising from that purchase agreement?
We have some things that have come up as far as, of course, she had students that were already enrolled when we took over. And so we have, as part of our agreement, we have written into our contract a way to manage that. She had obviously already received income for students that were now considered my students. So we have a reconciliation process that was written into our agreement that we work out. As a matter of fact, it'll be coming up at the end of July. You know, we'll be able to reconcile all of that. But other than that, for the most part, everything's been pretty smooth. Like I said, she's still on contract. She's definitely still part of the organization at this point, more as a consultant. So anything that comes up, you know, we've agreed to mediation if needed or whatnot, but there's been no major issues, no.
Okay, so you got compensated for the so to speak, students in process or students in midterm or mid-program?
Yes, we have a process for that.
Okay, absolutely. All right. Very good. And you still owe the former owner a fair amount of money right now. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, that's a fair statement. She's actually our, if you will, our lender. She agreed to basically finance the purchase of the company. So basically we just, instead of going through a bank and having a loan through the bank, we're basically her retirement.
Okay. And then, okay. You know, when I looked at your financial statements, it's, and I understand you're operating under pandemic conditions. When I looked at your, let me make sure I can pull that up. I think you have your 2020 financial statements here, don't you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, there they are. Sorry.
Okay.
Okay. I'm looking at your finance, and they're labeled cash basis, which, you know, is not my preference, but that's what you gave. But you have a profit and loss on an accrual basis, in which case you had a profit of $46,000 for the year ended December 2020. Meanwhile, you're paying $72,000 a year in debt service. Have you had to put more cash into the business to facilitate that or to enable
actually, it? No, I mean, we've been able to manage. Like I said, our enrollment obviously has been decreased from what Lynn had seen previously. Part of that is just the, you know, taking over and the change of ownership and kind of rebranding and getting, you know, marketing out there and basically reintroducing ourselves to our case managers and figuring out ways to reach people that weren't going through the different states that we have. So it's kind of been just more of the transition period that's kind of hindered some of that. But I think we're looking up. We haven't had any months where we've had no enrollment. But of course, some have been limited, you know, based on COVID, people on unemployment, not really wanting to get back into school quite yet, whatnot.
Okay. And are you able to pay yourself, you and Trish, for your services?
So we have not opted to take a salary as of yet. The reason for that is basically for the good of the business, but actually Trish and I are both employed. So we have taken this on to kind of make sure that we're, you know, starting on the right foot, basically. So neither of us are currently depending on this as an income per se, but wanted to take it on to make sure that we continue to run it. And then our goal is to eventually take an income. Yes.
Okay. Looking at your 2020 balance sheet, which is on the accrual basis, you have accrued liabilities of $21,000, and your payroll expense for the year was about $59,000. That's an extraordinary relationship. Are you including yourselves in the payroll and just not taking a check? Are you behind on your salaries, your payroll tax expense? There's something unusual about that relationship.
No, we don't include a salary for us, and we do have we have two employees, and then we have a third employee. So right now we're back down to two. I would have to verify why there's a discrepancy there, because neither of us take a salary. No, there's nothing there. So the 59,000, like I said, we have the two. I would have to go back and verify why there's a discrepancy there.
Well, the 59 might be fine. It's still owing 21,000 under payroll liabilities. That has me concerned. It's just a concern of mine. It's a concern that I don't want you to be in arrears on payroll tax expense. That's one of the most ugly.
I know, as of right now, our payroll expenses are definitely current, because our bookkeeper comes in every couple of weeks to make sure that everything is paid for us. So we do have a bookkeeper that handles that for us. We don't do that ourselves.
Okay. Changing the subject, have you been able to apply for and get recognition of the PPP loan as income as of now?
Yes, we have.
Okay. And then you have goodwill. I see that's recorded. It's not recorded on your accrual statements, but on your cash statements, but you might consider making that consistent.
Okay.
And on your accrual statements, you have $38,000 worth of accounts receivable. Why would you have accounts receivable?
Let me look at that.
Are you financing tuition?
Yes, we do. So we do have different options. So, yes, we do. We do have payment plans. So we would be taking that on. That would be where that would be coming from, yes.
Okay. All righty. Okay, that's all the questions I have right now. If there's other board members that have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace. I have just a comment on the statement that you made, Ms. Jones, about your bookkeeper taking care of payroll and all that. And I think it's great to have a bookkeeper, but I would strongly recommend that you and your partner become very fluent or literate in financial statements and being able to track the finances, you know, because I think the investment that you've made, you know, in this school is something that, you know, you're going to be involved in for a long time. And I think it's just, people tend to shy away from it, but it's not that hard. I'm not saying you shouldn't have a bookkeeper, but, you know, at the end of the day, you know, the buck stops with you guys, and it would be a shame if, you know, like, for example, Mr. Wallace brought up, I hope you're not behind in payroll taxes. Being behind in payroll taxes is like a devastating experience for a business. And so I think, and I'm not implying that you are, but just, you know, I think it's a great opportunity for you guys to, you know, to use that to you know, advance your school. So that's it. Just kind
absolutely.
Of
absolutely. Yes. Thank okay. you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. All right. Unless there are any other questions, Mr. Wallace, do you want to make a motion?
Yes, I make the motion that we approve the ownership transfer, and with the maintenance of the surety bond in the amount of $15,000.
Do you agree to the stipulation?
Yes, I do.
Second yes. that motion, Glenn Tharp, board member.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Wallace and Mr. Tharp. Mr. Lamont, you want to call the roll?
Certainly. Dr. Mittman?
Aye.
Mr. Romano?
Aye.
Mr. Lubke?
Aye.
Mr. Wallace?
Aye.
Mr. Tharp?
Aye.
Mr. Ball?
Aye.
By your vote of 6 ayes, no nays, the motion passes.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bon Butte Academy. Come on down. Mr. Romano, this is yours.
It is. Mr. LaMountain, would you provide an update?
Before the board today is the initial application for a conditional non-accredited vocational program for Bon Butte Academy located in Tucson, Arizona. Representing the institution today is Ms. Vanessa Baird. And Vanessa, I see that she is on.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. LaMountain. Ms. Baird, by all means, we've had a chance to review your information, but if you would like to provide us with any type of opening statement or update, we'd certainly appreciate that.
Sure, absolutely. My name's Vanessa Luna Baird. I have been in the beauty industry for 16 years, starting out as a makeup artist at 18, moving my way through various roles. About 6.5 years ago, I opened up my first business, which is a still business. It's a hair salon for independent booth renters. I just recently stepped away from hair in November to solely focus on cultivating my own brow artistry in permanent makeup, and have opened up a small little space right next door to accommodate me and my guests, as well as allow educational services to partake so I can also teach young or older growing beauty artists to learn a new skill that can be very sustainable and highly profitable. The academy is to teach the basics of how to successfully and safely microblade, but it's also intentionally infused with a certain code of ethics that I have found very helpful in my own conscious business practices and modeling from my 6.5 years of business ownership. And it's my hopes that with that intentional infusion in the how-to program, it will increase the success rate for the students that go through the program.
Great. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. I, as well as the other board members, have had a chance to review the information you provided. I have a couple areas I want to try and cover and a couple questions, but not too exhaustive. As I was reviewing your financials, I couldn't help but notice you had about $15,000 in what's termed as Clover sales, and I just didn't know what that was. I apologize for my ignorance.
Yeah, no problem. In fact, I will say I did invite my bookkeeper on. I forgot to update Kevin LaMountain prior, and she is also here viewing if she can help answer. I can answer that question. Clover sales are basically my point of sale system. So I also provide microblading as a service, and those sales are income from my own services acquired.
Got it. Thank you. I appreciate the clarity on that piece of it. Also, just to confirm a couple other elements, it looks like at this point, maybe you're feeling pretty optimistic about July coming up and the start of potentially having students. Is that an accurate statement?
Yes, me and my bookkeeper worked with that start date. However, after studying and reviewing my catalog, I did realize that my start date projection is mainly quarterly, and that would put me in August as far as that timeline. I have actually already had artists inquire about getting education from me. I have not solidified anything, just ethically not being considered a licensed program, but I have at least 6 people who have expressed interest to participate in that program.
Certainly understandable. We know that as we have seen a number of schools come forward over the last couple of years for microblading in particular, seems to be a high interest there. Nice opportunity, without a doubt, for people looking for that type of training. And also, as you mentioned, even in your materials, how it is currently, for the most part, very unregulated. Mm-hmm. So we appreciate your focus on the ethical side of that piece. Couple things to keep in mind. Understanding, yes, this is very exciting. It's a new business for you. It's hot in the marketplace. When you make claims like 6-figure businesses or salaries, you have to be able to reference where that's coming from. Mm-hmm. I realize you may be relying on your own experience or that of other microbladers that you have conversed with. But you can't just make a statement like that. You have to ground it in some type of factual information that's referenced, or else, as Mr. Thorpe responded earlier, you'll end up probably in front of the complaints committee, which can be frustrating at that point because a student's sitting there saying, they told me I'd be making 6 figures, and I'm not, mm-hmm. and that's frustrating. So. If you are going to call those out, please reference those. In addition, there's some other places where you use some strong language, like one of the fastest growing markets, right? And I realize probably in your lens that is very reasonable. However, again, you would need to reference where that information is coming from. So just think of it from the lens of a student of, hey, I'm reading this. Can they prove it or can they not? And mm-hmm. if you can't prove it, you should leave it off your materials. And that will probably keep you in a pretty safe area from that standpoint. You do have that information throughout your materials, like in your program and course of study form. On page 4, where you call out, 20,000 to 30,000 plus in salary, again, you would need to really review that and associate it with the source. And I think you'll be beneficial there. You'll also notice it's in your catalog on page 13. And I'm not trying to be exhaustive here. This is your responsibility to go back and look through all your materials to kind of clean that piece up so you don't get yourself in too much trouble from that point. Mm-hmm. couple other things that I noted. If I'm reading it correctly, and please validate, you have 14 hours of really hands-on experience of where they're working with the client. But then you call out the fact of they can only have two clients to work on. So I'm trying to validate and reconcile 14 hours of hands-on experience, but only two clients that they would actually do microblading on before they complete your program. Can you help me understand that?
Sure. I guess, so the 7 hours, I wouldn't necessarily, that came from the idea that microblading actually takes that long. A skilled microblade artist could finish a canvas in about 2.5 to 3 hours. That was really just plenty of cushion to allow the integration of the information of the days prior into the service. I don't expect them to take 7 hours at all for the client, but you know, I'm referring back to my own education, which I did go to a licensed school. It was very one after the other. And in my educational experience, it's just a little too much to absorb the information and the safety processes. So it's really there to help support the time, whatever time needed for the student to be very present with all aspects of the application itself. And of course, it's also free time that afterwards when their client leaves, if they need to, you know, revisit some things, it also gives us plenty of time to do that as well.
Thank you for that clarity. Certainly, you call it out. It was just hard for me to kind of get my arms around 14 hours, two clients, seemed a little thin from that point. But ultimately, from what you're describing, the plan would be they're on site. They may be doing that hands-on, but they're also, I guess, re-solidifying their preliminary education during that process. So
yes.
I'm comfortable with that explanation, and it helps me. So thank you from that standpoint. And then you were also kind enough to provide a PowerPoint of what I believe you'd be using in the classroom environment or possibly even through some type of orientation process. I did notice, and you have an inconsistency there, although it technically meets the refund standard. You call out the refund policy in that PowerPoint, but it is presented differently than that of how you presented in the EA and the course catalog. Again, it's you fall within the guidelines. Just caution that refunds are always complex to a student anyways. So when you're presenting it in multiple views, it can get a little confusing or could potentially, which again ends up where a student is bringing a complaint forward around their understanding or lack thereof of that. So I would just encourage you, I think it's a really good example that you provide on that PowerPoint. But you may want to just kind of cover your bases and still have the actual refund policy called out there as well. So it is consistent with what you have on the EA and also the catalog as well. But outside of that, really clean, really nice work between you and I think the board staff of preparing for this. Certainly very exciting. That's all the questions I have. Around that, and I'll turn it over to my other board members if they have any. Well, based on the, I guess, no noise or no questions, I'm going to say we're good to go. And if so, I'd like to propose a motion that we do approve the conditional non-accredited degree program license application with the stipulation for the 15,000 surety bond be in there.
I'll second that.
Ms. Beard, do you agree to those stipulations?
Yes.
Great. With that, Mr. LaMountain, would you like to take a roll call vote?
Great. Dr. Mittman?
Aye.
Mr. Romano?
Aye.
Mr. Lidke?
Aye.
Mr. Wallace?
Aye.
Mr. Tharp.
Aye.
Mr. Ball.
Aye.
By your vote of 6 ayes, no nays, the motion passes.
Congratulations, Ms. Beard. We look forward to seeing you again during your renewal process, and we wish you the best of luck with your business. Have a
great
day.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Great. Next up, University of Arizona Global Campus. I am the board lead. Mr. LaMountain, can you give us an intro, and then we'll introduce our representatives from the university.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Before the board today is the initial application for a regular accredited degree for the University of Arizona Global Campus. The University of Arizona Global Campus has a temporary location in Tucson, Arizona, and the information has been provided to you. There is one question that I think will need to be addressed that the university will, I'm confident, spend a few minutes on, which is the what is actually happening on the 9070 South Rita Road today and in the future, as we know that the institution will be relocating a number of individuals from California to Arizona. And I think that's a point that the board would want some clarification on what's happening today and what's moving forward. So Dr. Mittman.
Dr. Lafferty and Mr. Pastorek, would you like to make an opening statement?
Thank you, Dr. Mittman. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Very good. Thank you. Dr. Lafferty and I are here today with other members of our senior team and at your disposal to answer any questions you have. I'll just give you a brief introduction. We were before the board and did get approval to conduct operations some time ago as Ashford University. We are the University of Arizona Global Campus is the entity that acquired Ashford University effective December 1 of last year. We are an independent, not-for-profit university accredited by WASC. We are affiliated by contract with the University of Arizona, and that contract provides that we may use the name University of Arizona in connection with our university, thus University of Arizona Global Campus. We acquired the assets of Ashford University on December 1, and we received approval for the change in control from our accreditation agency, WASC. Ashford has been operating the university prior to us for 18 years. Ashford was owned by Zovio, a for-profit company. As part of the transaction in December of 2020, we also entered into an agreement with Zovio where they provide certain marketing, enrollment, and other OPM-like services to us. Now, as part of our agreement, we have the right and exercise the right to direct all of the actions of Zovio through written statements of work. And we have the right to hold Zovio accountable to faithfully execute that work through written key performance indicators, which have significant penalties for failure to perform. We serve well over 30,000 students in a full-service university, which is exclusively online. We offer associate, baccalaureate, master's, and doctoral degrees. During Ashford's existence, its principal office has been located in California. We're now looking to move our principal office to Arizona. The main reasons for the move are somewhat obvious, but important, our now affiliation with the University of Arizona, our desire to be proximately located to it, as well as our desire to be a part of Sarah and enjoy the benefits that Sarah offers to a university like ours, which works nationwide. We've advised WASC of our desire to move to Arizona, and if you grant our application to do so, I'm advised earlier today by our liaison at WASC that they will support that action. Those are my opening comments, Dr. Mittman, and I'll be happy to answer any questions, and my team also here will be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. I guess the first question that I have, and you referenced the key performance indicators. You know, we're familiar with Ashford University since they had a services center here starting in 2017, so they've been in front of the board before. We're also familiar, and I know this came up at the ABOR meeting last, I can't remember exactly when it was, but the complaints, you know, during the presentation from the president of the University of Arizona at ABOR, Board of Regents meeting, you know, they referenced the exceptional faculty at Ashford, high NESI scores, student engagement, student satisfaction, et cetera. And you know, and there's also the perception, you know, over the past decade or so that Ashford, you know, engaged in practices that resulted in litigation and state attorney generals, et cetera. And that part was all was all kind of on the Zovia side, which is who you've ended up partnering with. And I wonder, like, what, you know, what are the specific actions or the specific steps that or safeguards that you're taking to ensure that those practices, whether it's in recruiting or in collections or retention, et cetera, and graduation rates are not, you know, don't continue. Because I believe that the agreement with Zovia, you know, all of those, you know, or many of those fall within within that company.
Yes, I think that's right, Dr. Mittman. And great care was taken in the transaction to assure first that none of those liabilities would be visited upon the University of Arizona Global Campus. So the structure of the deal is that we acquired assets and not liabilities. So we're not responsible for the litigation that are out there. There are two particular ones that I'm aware of, including the California Attorney General litigation. That's number one. Number two, great care was taken to assure that we direct the actions of Zovio through statements of work in writing. We've, as of December 1st, have a list of statements of work that they are doing on our behalf. We are entitled under the contract to very specific reporting from them. And we're entitled to hold them to these key performance indicators. A key performance indicator, there are 20 plus of them. They range from enrollment to all forms of support that they provide to us. If there's a failure in any one year of any one of those key performance indicators, there's a $1 million penalty on Zovio. Number one. And number two, if there's a failure of 2 years in any 5-year period, then those services can no longer be performed by Zovio. So there are, as I said earlier, some significant penalties. Now, we are creating in the new University of Arizona Global Campus and a part of our organization that is compliance oriented. Compliance was managed by Zovio in the prior regime. But we are building our compliance function right now. We have a compliance function, but we are building a much stronger and robust compliance function. We have about 8 people right now who do compliance, but this organization will grow. One of the major ways that we have of assuring that Zovio follows our policies and follows our statements of work is we are able to record every conversation that is had with any student at any time by any member of Zovio. All of those recordings, all of those conversations are recorded. And we have an AI program that we can put in search words that search all of these conversations and provide us with information on any terms of concern that we might have. So we get reports anytime these words come up. We've actually gone to these audio tapes to listen to the recordings where we've had any issues of concern. We believe that is one of the best features of our ability to oversee them. Now, there are many other policies, many other checks, many other reports that are to be provided, and we have staff that will review and evaluate those to assure that we do not have that issue. And to be perfectly frank with you, I'm a new CEO and president of the organization. I was brought in. I was not affiliated with Ashford University. I was brought in by the University of Arizona to lead this organization and to provide basically a new tone and new attitude to work with Zovio, that we are in charge. We are the client. We will dictate the terms and circumstances of engagement with students, and they will comply. And I will tell you that they are operating under new management as well. And I personally have been very pleased with their attitude, their approach, their openness, their transparency. When we call, we ask, they provide information. And it's been a very collegial relationship that we've had over the last several months.
Thank you. During Dr. Wilson's presentation, he did reference at the Board of Regents hearing, he did reference improvements that were noted by WASC in Zovio's performance leading up to the acquisition by the University of Arizona. And I just have to say, your remarks and assurances are very heartening for 3 reasons. Number one, I think, Ashford University has a sizable student population, and for them to receive the education that they deserve and expect, I think will be enhanced by the guidelines that you've put into place, number one. Number two, as a board member, the Arizona Board for Private Postsecondary Education, our staff does a really great job. And so we love having schools in Arizona who represent the state well. And it puts the state in a good way. And then just the third one is my daughter was Wilma the Wildcat. And so I have a soft spot for the University of Arizona. And in case any, there are Sun Devils. My son did graduate from. and so thank you for that. In the presentation at the Board of Regents, there were a couple of references to the enrollment and also the market that Ashford versus University of Arizona has had. Ashford University, primarily in the eastern part of the United States, U of A online, more regionally, Arizona and California. The enrollment decline over the last, since the acquisition, so I have a couple of questions about that. Was that a decline that had started previously, because I know that there were a couple of years of declining enrollment at Ashford University, and so is this just following that trend line, or do you attribute it to, you know, the loss of brand equity, you know, that Ashford University had, and then all of a sudden it's like there's no more Ashford University and it's UAGC. And so if you could answer that first, and then I'd love to just delve into, you know, what UAGC has did, you know, initially to mitigate some of that, and what are your plans moving forward?
Very good. Thank you, sir. Enrollment at Ashford over many years has gradually declined from a high watermark about 10 years ago. However, during the year 2020, oddly enough, during the pandemic, it stabilized and flattened out. However, so I don't think the enrollment decline is so significantly related to this previous period, though I'm sure that could have something to do with it. You know, online is an industry that is very competitive, and you have to do things in order to maintain your competitive edge from an enrollment perspective. But I do think the largest there are really two reasons for I think the dip that we've seen so far. I think number one, it's the brand equity in Ashford. Ashford was a brand for 18 years. Lots and lots of money was spent in marketing that brand and building that brand. And, you know, we've let it go. We've converted it to the University of Arizona because of our affiliation with the university. And so it was expected that there would be a decline, very frankly. And, you know, we put certain measures in place to buttress that. But to be honest with you, the measures that you typically put in place, or you look to things like aggregator leads, and, you know, these aggregator leads are not always people who are truly interested. So it's not easy to make up for brand a loss, as we're doing here. And you rightly point out that we are seeing some shift in regional applications and admission. But there's another reason, I think, that we're seeing that dip, and perhaps not yet so much, but I think we're going to see, you know, still some more a dip in the enrollment, because we are working, as now the University of Arizona Global Campus, on doing a better job of assuring that students are ready for the college experience when they come. And we, in our prior experience as Ashford, we allowed students, I think, to come in and not really evaluate whether they're as committed as they need to be, because this is not, you know, this is serious business. And we want these students to know that. So we are actually taking some steps right now that changing courses, changing the way we structure our courses, changing the way we structure orientation, changing the way that we admit students. We don't have admission standards per se, but we want to make sure that, like, for example, all of the FAFSA application is fully complete before they start. We've been allowing them to go and not complete those, and then sometimes they fall out. They're not ready. We want them to be ready. We want to give them the best opportunity that they can have, but we don't want to push them into it, which is, I think, where you get into some of this old marketing kind of thing. So I think we're going to, first of all, we're financially stable right now. I'm very satisfied with where we are from a financial perspective. And as enrollment goes down, we can always adjust our cost structure. Zovio has announced an adjustment in their cost structure, and we can, although we have not yet. We're actually growing our part of the organization, because we've got to build some of our programs in a stronger way. So we've got the budget, we've got the plan to do that. We did not do a reduction or anything like that at this time. But I expect that enrollment will stabilize. I expect that enrollment will grow. We are actually having a major conversation within the university and with Zovio over new strategies for how we can get more students to be aware of the real competitive reasons for wanting to come to our university. You know, we want adult students who are trying to better themselves in their lives, and we think we have something special to offer, an incredible faculty, and I think a very flexible schedule in the way we do it. It's a pretty remarkable and interesting university. So we think we're going to stabilize. We think we're going to be fine. And but we're taking all necessary steps to assure that and to plan, if it doesn't, to plan and make sure that we're financially able to manage our way through and to serve our students no matter what.
Great. Thank you. Could you speak to, I believe it's University of Arizona Online, I think is the name, but U of A has about 5,000 students already enrolled in online education. Could you speak to the difference between, I mean, it could just be that the difference is, well, this is UAGC, it's a completely different school. But how do you, you know, either make the value proposition, or how do you distinguish, you know, in the minds of a consumer that I'm going to this school or I'm going to that school?
Excellent question, and it's one that we, in our discussions with our accrediting agency, had to deal with very specifically, with great thought and attention. And in fact, we just had a post. A change of control site visit with the accreditation agency last week. Many questions were asked along these lines because they want to assure that students understand what they're getting and that they're getting what they wanted to get. You know, the University of Arizona Online, now called Arizona Online, which is the University of Arizona's part of the University of Arizona, in fact, has close to 7,000 students now. It's grown over the last year or so. But it does cater to a different market than we cater to. It has, I believe, 6 or 8 starts a year. We have 50 starts a year. We start every week. If you want to go to the University of Arizona Global Campus next week, you can start, provided you're admitted and you fill out all of the required application forms, et cetera. So the amount of flexibility that you have in coming to Global Campus is significantly greater. And the reason is we're really targeting working adults. Our average age of student is in the range of 26 to 28. The average range of students at Arizona Online is typically what you would expect to see going into an on-ground university. Kids who are in it to do the traditional undertaking. Another thing that's different about the way we serve students is they take one course at a time. They complete the course, take a week off, and then resume another course, which is sequentially designed to follow behind it. These are 5-week courses, which you take sequentially. Whereas in Arizona Online, you take a traditional load like you would take in an on-ground university. You may be taking 12 hours, you may be taking 15, 9, whatever. But you'll be taking multiple classes at a time and 3 days a week, whereas with us, you'll be doing the work every day and completing it in the 5-week period. So there is a different value proposition. Now, One of the things that we've done in working with our accreditation agency is we've developed a process to identify students who may be mistaken in their intent to apply to University of Arizona Global Campus and then really intend to go to the University of Arizona. We don't want that to happen. And so we put different mechanisms in place, and we have, and we just reported this to the accreditation agency. We had in the first 5 months or 4 months of operation, I believe, about 117 students out of about 45,000 applicants that chose that in the course of discussion, we realized they really wanted the University of Arizona online. So we refer them over to the University of Arizona online. And interestingly, there are some who apply to University of Arizona online and want the flexibility and options that we afford, and online then refers them over to us. We're continuing that monitoring. We're even doing some secret shopping kinds of activities and, you know, making sure that students understand this as best as we can.
Great. Mr. LaMountain referenced earlier about the plans for a permanent home or long-term home in Tucson. And I can't remember the number of faculty in the San Diego area, but it's fairly substantial. Are they going to be moving over, or how are you going to manage that? I guess especially since it's predominantly online, and so do they actually have to move over to Tucson?
You know, it's a great question, and the pandemic has changed, you know, the mindset around this. It's fascinating. The plan is that we will be having a footprint in either the Phoenix or the Tucson area. Of course, University of Arizona has a number of operations in Phoenix as well as Tucson. And we're exploring both of those and, you know, where the best benefit would be for both us and long-term the University of Arizona. We do have a small office in Tucson in addition to the one you described that we got approved for before, because we really don't use that previously approved office at this point. So in order to get this process started, we put up our office on the University of Arizona site in Tucson. But we plan on doing a full-scale office, and we'll probably announce that in the next 60 days. We're very close to completing that. Now, in terms of permanent staff, we housed about just under 100 or around 150 full-time employees in San Diego. Many of the other full-time employees were not actually housed in the building. And then most of our faculty are adjunct. All of them are online. They don't serve in a building. All total, we have about 2,500 people associated part-time or full-time with the university. I expect that we're not going to make everyone in San Diego move upon the approval of a change in the principal office. We're going to allow that to happen over time, but we already have a number of employees that are in Arizona, and we will be moving some of our employees over to Arizona, but we're going to allow that to happen. In some cases, it'll be mandatorily, but in most cases, it'll be a product of movement of people who want to move and are okay to move. We'll take advantage of all of these new resources that we have, Zoom and Google Meets and so forth, in the meantime, especially because we are an online university. But I would expect that by the end of this year, we would have a presence of an office space of probably 10,000 to 12,000 square feet minimum in either Phoenix or Tucson for the purpose of housing people on a permanent basis.
Okay. I have a couple other questions before I turn it over to other board members, but Mr. LaMount, did you have a follow-up on the location before I ask a couple of other questions?
Thank you, Dr. Whitman. Mr. Pistorik, the question that we have is still, you know, once this license is approved, if it is approved today, then you, in terms of our consideration for the university, your home state is Arizona.
Correct.
And that will obviously help you as you move through the process with Sarah and such. The question that we have is on an enrollment agreement. Right now, your current enrollment agreement still state California as opposed to Arizona. Certainly that would, for us, the preference is very much to have it an Arizona-based enrollment agreement, an Arizona-based catalog with all of the information that shows. And I know that at this point in time, you have a temporary address on Rita Road down in Tucson. And right. If that's the location, that's fine. And then if you move that particular location, you submit a change of location form with us. It doesn't go before the board. It's just at the staff level. But we would certainly want some clarity on when a student signs that enrollment agreement, what state are they signing that enrollment agreement to? And the answer, if you're approved today, is Arizona.
Arizona, absolutely. Yes, sir. No, we want to move our operations and all of our licensing and agreements and everything to Arizona. I don't want to be presumptuous. We'll allow the board to reflect and take action. But once it does, we will be shifting all of that to Arizona. Absolutely. Yes, sir.
Okay. And Dr. Mittman, that was my big question, so thank you.
Okay. Last two questions for me, and I'll turn it over to the other board members. I don't know how many alumni Ashford University produced over 18 years, but I assume it's in at least the tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands. And I'm just wondering, you know, how did you manage that? Did they still have Ashford University diplomas? Did you give them the option for the other? How does the Alumni Association deal with this? And how do you leverage the fact that now as a not-for-profit university, you know, you have a different relationship with the alumni and hopefully, you know, moving forward as a source of development?
Another great question. First of all, it's over 100,000 alumni that have graduated from the university. I was literally just talking about this question yesterday. You know, part of our plan with the University of Arizona is that people who attended Ashford will be included in alumni benefits that the University of Arizona alumni share. We're in discussions with the university about the details of that. But that was part of the original discussions, is that our alumni would be embraced by the Wildcat community. And, you know, the precise details are to be worked out. I was talking to an alumnus the other day. He was telling this incredible story of his experience at Ashford. A gentleman who served for 20 years in Navy SEALs and some of those years in Afghanistan, and acquired his degree in part when he was in the service and in combat, which is remarkable. He went on from Ashford University to the University of Southern California, got an MBA, and is now a very successful businessman. And we were talking about how we can reach out to our Ashford alumni, how we can engage them, what are the kinds of things that people would be interested in so that when we sit down with the University of Arizona and we talk about bridging these alumni into the Wildcat community, how we would do that. And I think we have a great opportunity. We've been working with the University of Arizona Foundation. They're actually a member, the member of our corporation. As a legal matter, Arizona law requires that you have a member. And the University of Arizona Foundation is our member. So I've been in discussions with the executive director about these kinds of things, and we're working through that. But development is a big issue for us. We're excited about the fact that we got approved by the IRS on nonprofit status. We do have to wait for final approval by the U.S. Department of Education. They get to say grace over nonprofit status for department purposes. We don't expect that anytime soon. It's a year-long process. But we really want to take advantage of that, and we're hoping to do so.
Okay. And you didn't get a lot of flack from the Ashford alums about changing the name?
No, I think they're intrigued by the relationship with the University of Arizona. They still love their heritage. I mean, Ashford means a lot to these people and meant a lot to them when they got their degree. So we don't want to say it goes away, but we want to say they're part of the University of Arizona Global Campus community. And as we negotiate with the University of Arizona, part of the University of Arizona community.
Okay. And then my last question, and is, you know, one of the, I think, flagship programs at Ashford and now at UAGC is the Forbes School of Business. And then at U of A, you have Eller. And I just wonder how you're going to keep the two apart. And I bring this up just so that I could talk about my daughter, who gave the commencement address as a student from Eller. And so
wow.
I'm fine, you know, I'm not like an Eller, you know, huge booster, but I was just wondering, how do you navigate, you know, two very prominent names and, you know, and a program, especially here in Arizona, that has, you know, such great currency?
Yeah, the Eller School is a remarkable institution. I've had the pleasure of speaking with the dean and learning more about it. Actually, one of the professors of the Eller School is on the board of directors of the University of Arizona Global Campus. We have four University of Arizona members on our 9-member board who are from the Arizona University of Arizona community. So we're very sensitive to the importance and value of Eller. We're very proud of the Forbes name and the Forbes School of Business and Technology, and it's served us very well. I was on a call with Mr. Forbes not more than a couple of weeks ago. He's on our advisory board to the university. You know, we think there's room for both of these again, because the people who are looking at Eller are looking for a particular kind of brand and a particular kind of value proposition. And the Forbes people are very moved by the fact that they're in the business world. Forbes is a name in the business world, and it matters for them and their employability. So Dr. Lafferty and I get on the phone with lately, our Zoom calls lately, with the provost, her counterpart, at the University of Arizona, our deans, the dean of the Forbes School and the dean of our College of Arts and Sciences, get on with their deans, and we talk once a month, and we talk about the opportunities that we have to work together. And one of the aspects of the affiliation agreement with the University of Arizona is something called the Joint Academic Advisory Council. And it's intended to have members of both the University of Arizona and the University of Arizona Global Campus to work on how we can be partners and work collaboratively with each other And I expect that things like our relationship between Forbes and Eller will be addressed in there so that we can make sure that we're working in as collaborative an environment as we can.
Great. Well, thank you very much. Questions from other board members, since I've monopolized the time so far?
Dr. Bittman, I would say you covered mine, certainly. I will just offer from a student perspective or consumer perspective, I am a little concerned of how students are going to really appreciate and understand that the University of Arizona Global Campus is not the University of Arizona, and how they navigate through consumer complaints and what that looks like, as it feels like the University of Arizona has licensed their brand to a different organization, and how a student, when they see the emblem, if I were a student signing up, I'd say, I go to University of Arizona, not maybe appreciating and understanding this, the separateness of this entity, and that creates pause for me, but certainly not within the scope of what we do. I just share that for the record of my concern of what that looks like and how students of the University of Arizona Global Campus, when coming in front of the Complaints Committee, start expressing concerns of, I thought I was at the University of Arizona and I don't feel as though I was made aware that this was a separate entity. And I'll leave it at that.
You know, I think that's a very fair question, and it's why we have gone to lengths to assure that students who are making inquiries are routed to the University of Arizona. And what another thing that I would tell you we've done is we've tried, not tried, we've made ourselves very familiar with the offerings of the University of Arizona to make sure that when students are reaching out to us, that when they describe offerings, it's offerings that we have and that are not ones that University of Arizona has. Another thing I would mention in the for what it's worth category is this is apparently, we're not the first to use this model. You know, Colorado State, I think, has the same thing. University of Maryland does. There are some different structures and imports between the two. But I think you're right. I mean, we have to be careful. We have to assure that we're taking the steps to make sure that students know. And this is really the WASC issue that probably there were two predominant issues that we dealt with WASC. One was retention, persistence, and completion, and its desire to see us improve, which we're working very hard on, Dr. Lafferty and her team. But the other was this brand confusion, and that's why I say, you know, they put conditions in their change of control to assure that we were taking the appropriate steps. We had the site visit last week for the purpose of assessing how we've been doing in that regard. And I think we will, we have other site visits that we'll be seeing in the future. And they're going to be, I'm sure this is going to be a topic of granular concern to them. Whereas it's not necessarily in your ambit, it is in theirs, and they're holding us to account.
I appreciate that response. Thank you.
Other board members? Okay, hearing none. Hold on a sec, I have another screen here. Where I did not write the motion. Hearing none, I would like to make a motion, and I'm going to ask Mr. LaMountain to read the staff recommended motion for me.
Okay. I don't have it. Certainly, and Dr. Mittman and members of the board, a question that I have for the board is a determination of the surety bond. In the document that I provided you, and based upon various numbers that we've received from the university about the number of Arizona students and the general population, along with some of the concerns that we may have had moving over from Ashford into this transition into the University of Arizona Global, there is an option here of a bond from the low end of $827,400 to a maximum based upon the numbers that they provided, that the University of Arizona Global provided, to $1,446,200. So I would need a recommendation from the board of where you'd like that surety bond number to fall.
Okay. Well, and actually I just pulled up the document that I was gonna ask you to read. So from a board discussion, I think in all fairness, you know, for a new school, especially a school with a sizable student population, it should be the calculation based on the actual numbers. And so based on the actual numbers of Arizona based students, would that be the high number, Mr. LaMountain, or somewhere in between?
It's going to be somewhere in between. And I think it's the level of comfort that you have with where you want the number to be, because we are talking about not exact numbers at this point, particular point in time.
Okay. Well, I don't know. Does anyone else on the board want to weigh in on this? I have to say that, you know, my comfort level based on the application, based on the presentations that I saw at the Board of Regents, and also the backing of the university, even though they are two separate entities, you know, I would recommend towards the lower end, and so just as a round number, $1 million surety bond, given the range of $827,000 and $1.4 million. And so unless other board members feel otherwise, hearing none, I'm going to...
Dr. Mittman, sorry, yeah. Dr. Mittman. I'm hesitant. I guess I'm trying to appreciate why we can't just lock in on a firm number that's consistent with our other methodology versus this interpretation that we're trying to make right now. I realize that student amounts and revenue will fluctuate during a period of time anyways, but I guess I'm struggling to understand why this is a unique case where we're having to deviate from our typical practices.
Okay. Mr. Do you want to clarify?
Yes. Dr. Mittman and Mr. Romano, the challenge that we've had is a definitive number coming from the University of Arizona Global Campus of how many students that are represented in the number that we would typically do a calculation on. Keeping in mind that as of the transition, if this is approved today, in reality, the state of Arizona oversees then all of the institution and all of the students. We have one level or another of accountability for the financial. If we were to look at the student tuition recovery fund component of it, which typically is one of the reasons why you have the bond, is based upon the number of students that the University of Arizona Global Campus has today and as they move forward, because of the time frame that we're looking at here, of what that number really is. So the bottom line number is based on the, I believe they reported 1900. Again, it's 00, so we don't know what the absolute number is. We can get some additional clarification, but for today's purpose, if you were to go on that low number of 827.4, that certainly could be acceptable. That would be the baseline. And if things change, we would certainly we would not have an opportunity unless the institution was placed on a financial oversight. The next time that we would have the opportunity to review the application would be next year. It would be, and then we could reassess the bond at that point. The institution, by the way, is aware of this.
Yeah, I guess what I'm going to take away from that is what you said right at the beginning, which is the institution has failed to provide the accurate number necessary to do the calculation. And that's what needs to be resolved. I don't know if we can make a motion that associates, you know, the institution providing that number and then us just following the basic formula that we followed. I would hate to get into a practice of where now we're deviating from a school's obligation to report and being consistent with the way this this amount is determined. So I don't know if we have that option there to make that as part of the motion that the school would have to report that, and that would be that would hold them up on the approval. But assuming they could, that the surety bond amount would be calculated from that, consistent with our other practices.
Mr. Lupke has his hand raised, and then I will. What I can do in terms of addressing that particular is that we can't. The preference would be to have a minimum today, and if that number changed, we would. And I'd have to check with the Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan of whether or not we have the ability to go back and lower or raise that based on new numbers that come in. But Mr. Lupke?
Yes, Mr. Lamouton, just a clarifying question. Which students are eligible to make a claim on our STRIFE fund? Just Arizona residents?
Yes, any student whose contract states that their residence is in the state of Arizona would be eligible for the student tuition recovery fund. Okay. All other students would be responsible. Any other student in any other state would be then have the opportunity to use that state's student tuition recovery fund. One of the challenges that because the institution is not a SARA school, there's certainly no coverage under SARA for those particular students. It would be California, and then any state that the University of Arizona Global Campus is licensed in.
I see. All right, very good. Thank you.
Sure.
Could I ask a question? If I'm not out of order, I apologize. If I am,
sure.
I'm not clear on what we may have failed to provide. Because I believe that we provided the information regarding our Arizona students through Jim Smith, who is our CFO, provided that information. When did you do that, Jim? Through what date?
Yeah, we were projecting not only end of our fiscal year numbers, but providing both that number as well as the average enrollment for the next 2 years, so for fiscal years 22 and 23. We absolutely have a census as of this very moment of our Arizona student population that we can provide if that is needed, but I believe that request went to the staff level based on my feedback from our team. But we can provide whatever follow-up data is needed if for some reason that wasn't abundantly clear in what we had provided as part of the application.
I think I understood, and this is just what I understood, so I don't pretend to know all the rules, but what I understood was the number that we had provided would generate the 847 lower band number. Now, I respect the board and whatever decision it makes, but that was just my understanding based on the numbers we provided. So If we need to provide anything else, we'll certainly provide it. But that's what I understood our number generally.
And Dr. Mittman, that would be correct. At the 827, 827.4 would be the low end of the number, and as Mr. Smith discussed, they did provide the projections moving forward because of we're getting close to the, I believe, the end of their fiscal year, additional projections that they have moving forward, that the risk to the state may change dramatically between now and, you know, and a few months from now. But the bottom of A27.4 would be the calculation that we could certainly use today to move this forward.
Could I ask Assistant Attorney General Monahan to just weigh in so that, you know, since this is a new program here and the expectation would be that enrollment will grow, is that a figure that can change or can the surety bond change in the future? And if so, at what intervals?
Thank you, Board Chair, members of the board. This is Seamus Monahan, Assistant Attorney General. You know, if this is something that you would like to go into executive session to discuss further and look through your statutes, I'd be willing to do that. However, everything that Kevin has said today is correct. You are somewhat bound by the numbers that are provided to you. And there's other factors that you can take into consideration. However, changing, there is no authority one way or the other to change or not change the surety bond at a later date. If the board wanted to, what they could do is approve the license with the understanding, delegating the authority to the board's executive director to issue the correct bond based on the numbers that are provided. But what it sounds like is that the institution is saying that they have provided those numbers.
Well, that's a good path forward. So I guess the question, Mr. LeMountain, would you prefer that extra time so that we could approve, or assuming that we can make a motion to approve the regular accredited degree program license and the exact details on the surety bond will be calculated with you, your staff, and representatives of UAGC.
Dr. Mittman, members of the committee, I think the preference would be that we do the 827-4 with, so, and again, is what Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan mentioned, is that the board has the ability to take the minimum and say that's what we want to do, but the board also has the ability and the authority to make basically any number above that, if that so choose, or below that, if the board chooses as well. So I think one of the opportunities here that we would have is if we approved at the 827-4, and then as we move through other processes with the institution, if there were challenges, if there were other concerns that we would have, we would bring that before the board and ask for a bond reduction or a bond increase based on activities that we see and that we monitor throughout the year.
Okay. So, Mr. Romano, are your concerns and issue that you raised, is that satisfactory to you?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Well, good. Well, then I am going to make the motion to approve the regular accredited degree program license application with a stipulation that a surety bond in the amount of $827,400. Can I get a second?
Second, Glenn Burr, board member.
Okay. And folks at UAGC, do you agree to that stipulation?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. Then, Mr. LeMountain, you want to call the roll?
Yes. Dr. Mittman?
Aye.
Mr. Romano?
Aye.
Mr. Lukey?
Aye.
Mr. Wallace?
Aye.
Mr. Tharp?
Aye.
Mr. Ball?
Aye.
By your vote of 6 ayes, no nays, the motion would pass.
Great. Well, thank you very much. And do you guys also get bear down, or is that...
Bear down. It was bear down, mask up. But I just, on behalf of the institution and Dr. Lafferty, I just want to thank the members for your attention and your patience and your concern for the citizens of Arizona in your work today. So thank you very much. And we look forward to working with you in the future. We're excited to be coming to Arizona. We'll see you soon.
Okay. Look forward to it. Yeah. Be well. Great.
Thank you.
Call to the public. Are there any folks on the either phone or Google Meetup, whatever we're doing here, that would like to make a comment? If not, I would like to just do a shout out just in case Fred Lockhart is still on the call. And I don't see it, but it's always great to see Fred and also Terry Stanfill. Hearing none, it is 12:40.
Thank you.
Okay. It's at 12:40. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Great job, you guys. Thank you very much. All
great meeting. Have fun.